Mr. Kelly probably mentioned to you that he was going to be making a church visit to Kansas, and he has already left, so that's why I'm here today. He mentioned to me that about half of you had the Acts of the Apostles class last semester, and some of what I'm going to give you this morning will be review. You'll recall that last semester I spoke on the subject of Simon Magus in the Acts of the Apostles class. Today I'm supposed to speak on Simon Magus and Gnosticism, so there will be some overlap. Mr. Kelly said that a review would not hurt. I don't know if that was based on your exam performance, but there will be some review for those of you who've been here before. I have added some new material here and there, so be alert for that as we go through this. There are three main sources of information on the life and the infamous career of Simon Magus. Justin Martyr, and I have these names on the board. Irenaeus, both of them were 2nd century writers, 2nd century AD. And also Eusebius, who was a 4th century historian. In fact, he is known as the father of church history. So those three sources, Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, and Eusebius, will be the main sources for what I'm going to give you this morning. According to Justin Martyr, Simon Magus was born in a village in Samaria near the modern-day city of Nablus, close to the site of Shechem, which you might recall is the village between Mount Ebal and Gerizim. Simon was born about the same time as Jesus. He was a descendant of the Babylonian and the Assyrian colonists who had been brought by the king of Assyria into the land of Israel in place of the 10 tribes that were carried away captive. Of course, you can read about that in 2 Kings 17. Now, these Samaritans were a mixed race, but they had a heathen Babylonian core. And outwardly, they revered Yahweh as the god of the land, but their religion was simply outright paganism. They were practicing Babylonians. And Simon was of this stock. Now, it's believed he was educated at Alexandria in Egypt, and that there he became acquainted with the tenets of the Gnostic school of thought. And either then or subsequently, Simon became a pupil of a man named Dositheus. That's spelled D-O-S-I-T-H-E-U-S. This Dositheus preceded Simon as a teacher of Gnosticism in Samaria. Gnosticism, in fact, was centered in Samaria at this time, a region that was notorious for blending together various religious concepts. There's a term for that, for the blending together of various religious ideas. The term is syncretism. You should be aware of that. S-Y-N-C-R-E-T-I-S-M, syncretism. So they would pick and choose from various religions the elements of those religions that attracted them. This was widely practiced in Samaria. Now, I've mentioned Gnosticism and that Simon probably became acquainted with the tenets of Gnosticism in Alexandria, and then later taught these doctrines in Samaria. So we need to look, first of all, at what is Gnosticism. This was a major heresy that troubled the early church. Now, Gnosticism, I should emphasize, predates Christianity. It's not a heresy that grew out of Christianity, but it was in existence before the birth of Christ. It had its origins in the Greco-Roman world. And this religion of Gnosticism was syncretistic in character. Again, there's that word. It drew its inspiration from various sources, from various religions, Babylonian religion, Persian religion, and others. The Gnostics comprised numerous different groups. There were widely scattered parties, at least 50 different sects of Gnosticism, which followed different leaders. There were Jewish types and pagan types of Gnosticism. So it was not one homogeneous movement, but comprised of numerous groups. Gnosticism was brought into Christianity by Simon Magus, and also by another individual I'll be discussing, a man named Cerinthus, C-E-R-I-N-T-H-U-S. So it predates Christianity and was brought into Christianity by Simon Magus and Cerinthus, sometimes pronounced Corinthus. Gnosticism was a dualistic religion. Dualism says basically that reality is two-sided. Reality is two-sided. And these realities are in opposition to one another, such as matter and spirit, good and evil, light and darkness. And we see why it's called dualism. Now, Gnosticism, as I said, was a dualistic religion. It had elements of dualism in it. Let me give you a definition of Gnosticism. This is the one that Mr. Kelly has in his notes, so I'll just give it to you word for word, and you can write it down. Gnosticism is the thought and practice of various dualistic cults of late pre-Christian and early Christian centuries, distinguished by the conviction that matter is evil and spirit good, and emancipation or salvation is attained only through gnosis, a Greek word, G-N-O-S-I-S. I'll read that one more time. Gnosticism, the thought and practice of various dualistic cults of late pre-Christian and early Christian centuries, distinguished by the conviction that matter is evil and spirit good, and emancipation or salvation is attained only through gnosis. So let's define this word gnosis, this Greek word, G-N-O-S-I-S. It means essentially esoteric knowledge or mystical knowledge, a type of supernatural wisdom, you might say. Now notice, firstly, that there is an important link between Gnosticism and Christianity in that both stressed personal salvation. Both place stress on personal salvation. But in Gnosticism, salvation was for the few, for those few who were capable of spiritual enlightenment, capable of acquiring this gnosis, this supernatural wisdom or mystical knowledge. So there was a major difference. The Gnostics equated spirituality with knowledge. Now we know that a person is not saved by knowledge, but the Gnostics, in fact, used that term, saving knowledge. We know that eternal life is a gift. It's a gift that is received by God's grace through faith. But in the Gnostic scheme of things, salvation came by accumulating knowledge. Now let me also explain an important Gnostic doctrine. Since matter is evil, as the Gnostics held, certainly the supreme being of the universe, this, you know, the high good God, could not have created something evil. So the Gnostics said that since matter is evil and God, the supreme being, is perfect and good, the material universe, consequently, must not have been created by God, the supreme being. So the Gnostics declared that the material world was created by a subordinate deity, whom they titled the Demiurge, Demiurge. That's one word, capital Demiurge. Now this Demiurge was not the supreme being, not the high God, but an inferior, and in fact they also used the term imperfect being. A deity, yes, but an inferior and imperfect being under the supreme God. This word Demiurge comes from a Greek word, Demiurgos, Demiurgos, which means craftsman. This being was the craftsman or the creator of the material world. And also, the Gnostics identified this Demiurge with the God of the Jews, the God of the Old Testament. So in their belief, the God of the Old Testament was not the supreme being, but this inferior deity. I think most of you are aware of the problems in such an argument when we hold this idea up to the teachings of Christianity. This Demiurge idea is refuted most succinctly by Colossians 1, verses 13 to 22. You might just want to put that in your notes and look at that entire section. In fact, that first chapter of Colossians is believed to have been written especially to refute the ideas of Gnosticism in this regard. Colossians 1, verses 13 to 22. Now, we're going to be talking primarily today about Simon Magus, but I did mention that there was another individual, Cerinthus, who was also instrumental in introducing Gnosticism into Christianity. And I'd just like to say a few words about him before we go on to Simon Magus. Cerinthus. He was a Christian heretic. If you were to look the name up in an encyclopedia, that's how he would be labeled, and that is true. A Christian heretic of Jewish birth, educated in Alexandria, Egypt. Mr. Armstrong used to refer to Alexandria as the hotbed of heresy, and that certainly was the case. And again, this Gnostic school was quite prominent in Alexandria. Now, this Cerinthus was younger than Simon Magus. It's believed that he may have been associated with Simon Magus, but Cerinthus himself did not really make much of a public impact until about the year 88 A.D. Now, this was two decades after Simon Magus was dead. Simon Magus died in A.D. 68 in the city of Rome. And Cerinthus, as I said, did not publicly make an impact until two decades later, A.D. 88. But it is believed he may have been associated with Simon Magus in earlier years. Now, this Cerinthus headed a sect of Jewish Christians with Gnostic tendencies. And Irenaeus mentions that the Apostle John, the last surviving of the original 12, considered Cerinthus to be the supreme enemy of Christianity at that time. And according to Irenaeus, John wrote his gospel to confute the errors of Cerinthus. We'll see in a moment what some of those errors were. Irenaeus relates an incident that he attributes to Polycarp, or at least Polycarp, in other words, described this incident to Irenaeus. Polycarp said that John, the Apostle John, one day was going to bathe at one of the public baths in Ephesus, and arriving there, he saw Cerinthus within, and John immediately leapt out of the bath, as it says in Irenaeus' account, saying to Polycarp, quote, "Let us flee, lest the bath fall in while Cerinthus, the enemy of the truth, is within," unquote. He saw him as a supreme enemy, evil personified, and was even afraid the bath might fall in because Cerinthus was present there. Now, this Cerinthus, again, taught various Gnostic doctrines, including that of Docetism, D-O-C-E-T-I-S-M. Docetism, an important doctrinal position of Gnosticism. And I'll just briefly explain what that is. Again, if matter is imperfect and impure and evil, as the Gnostics allege, then, of course, the physical body is impure and imperfect and evil. So, that then presents a problem when it comes to Jesus Christ. At least the Gnostics thought there was a problem. Because how could you have God inside this evil flesh? So this is the way Cerinthus and other Gnostics who had become acquainted with Christianity and had in their way, and according to their definitions, become Christians, this is how they explained this. They said that the earthly Jesus was simply a mere man. He was the son of Mary and Joseph. Not of Mary and of God, but of Mary and Joseph. A physical, earthly man. But that he was the vehicle of a higher being. The heavenly Christ. Who acted in him and through him, but without really being incarnate. In other words, to even be more specific, they claim that Jesus received Christ at his baptism. Well, there's a strange doctrine. That Jesus received Christ, received this heavenly Christ at his baptism. The impression you get when you read explanations of their doctrine is that almost like the heavenly Christ possessed the physical body of the man Jesus at the time of baptism. And that later they say that this Christ left Jesus before his crucifixion. So it was only a temporary union, not really an incarnation in that sense. So in essence, what they were saying is that Christ never really came in the flesh. You know, after all, flesh is evil, isn't it? So Christ never really came in the flesh, but he had this temporary union with the man Jesus, as I explained. So Cerinthus and his Gnostic-leaning associates denied the real humanity of Jesus Christ and denied his actual death. So this, as you see, is an outgrowth of the idea of in Gnosticism that matter is evil. Now, there was another form of Docetism, which I should mention. You see, there was not ever complete unity on any of these doctrines. Another form of Docetism alleged that Christ did not have a natural or a physical body while he was on earth, and not even a borrowed one, quote-unquote, as I just explained, but only an apparent or a phantom body. as they put it. Some sort of an ethereal or heavenly or ghost-like body, not made of flesh and blood, but a phantom-type body. He just looked like he was physical. His 12 disciples there, as they would have explained it, perceived him as being a flesh and blood human being, but really he wasn't. It was just an apparent body that it looked like flesh and blood, but it wasn't. And again, they took this approach because they felt that matter, including the physical body, was evil, and how could God be dwelling in a house of evil? So I think you get the idea there. Now, the Apostle Paul warned the churches about these Gnostic teachings in many different scriptures. Some elements in the church, as the decades went on, were trying to make Christianity intellectually acceptable. They were trying to make it conform more to the generally accepted standards and practices and philosophies of the age. In other words, to make it more palatable and more intellectually acceptable. And to do so, they tried to explain Christian doctrine in some of the high-flown terminology and sophisticated reasoning of Gnosticism. And again, Gnosticism was quite prevalent in this first century A.D. So it wasn't necessarily that many of these elements in the church were consciously trying to subvert the church. They were just trying to make it intellectually respectable and explain Christian doctrine in terms of the accepted, widely accepted Gnostic philosophy. There is some similarity there, I think, to the liberal elements among us back in the 70s that worked on the now infamous STP, the project to explain church doctrine and to make it intellectually acceptable and put it in terms that might be a little more palatable to the world. Well, there might be some connection or some similarity there. In any case, whatever the motivation, this was certainly an evil heresy that totally was in opposition to the true doctrines of the church. And Paul warned the church about these Gnostic teachings. For example, in 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 7 to 10, we're not going to turn to these scriptures, but you can put them in your notes. This was around 50 A.D., talking about the mystery of iniquity, probably referring to Simon Magus and his introduction of Gnosticism into Christianity. Of course, this is also a type of the false prophet of the end time. But he talks about the mystery of iniquity does already work. Also in Galatians 1, verses 6 to 7, this was about 3 years later, talking about another gospel, a perverted gospel being preached. And as I mentioned before, the entire book of Colossians is devoted to dispelling the teachings of Gnosticism. If you read through Colossians with the tenets of Gnosticism in mind, you'll see how very specifically many of these Gnostic ideas are addressed by the Apostle Paul and refuted. Also, 1 Timothy 6, verses 20 to 21 would be another passage. In the general epistles as well, 3 John, verses 9 to 10. 3 John 9 to 10. Diotrephes is believed to have embraced the type of Gnosticism. Also in 1 John chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. 1 John 4, 1 to 3. Now here's a direct statement refuting the idea of Docetism. You know, John says, if they say that Christ did not come in the flesh, they're not of God. Now, that's a direct statement trying to warn off Christians from embracing Docetism and other Gnostic doctrines. Jude 4 is another example, talking about certain men crept in unawares into the church, spreading these pernicious doctrines. So there are many examples. I won't give you any more, but the apostles were warning the churches about these teachings, and these teachings were very widely prevalent and were creating a problem among those who were not firmly rooted in the truth. Now, as I said, Simon Magus was instrumental in introducing Gnosticism into Christianity, but his religion went far beyond just simple Gnosticism. In fact, Simon Magus, as I think all of you are aware, in time had become the high priest of the Babylonian Samaritan mystery religion. Now, this mystery religion had adopted elements of Gnosticism, but it also included heathen doctrines going way back to the time of Nimrod and the time of ancient Babylon. This religion had been brought to Samaria by the Assyrians after the captivity of the house of Israel. I mentioned 2 Kings 17, and had taken root in Samaria. And being a syncretistic sort of religion, adopted elements of other religions as the centuries went on, including elements of Gnosticism. Simon Magus, in fact, was the successor to Nimrod and to Balaam. Remember, Balaam was this mercenary heathen diviner who was involved in seducing the Israelites to commit fornication with the Moabite women. So he was a successor to these and other former high priests of the Babylonian mystery religion. He was a magician and a sorcerer. The Latin word magus means sorcerer or magician. That's why he is referred to as Simon Magus. He was involved in black magic and demonism and so on. Justin Martyr says that Simon's magic was performed by the operations of demons. Sorcery is magic involving the invocation of evil spirits, with its aim being to harm or to injure or to deceive. So Simon was intimately tied up with demons. Justin Martyr identifies Simon Magus with Simon the Samaritan, mentioned in Acts chapter 8. The events of Acts 8 took place in AD 33. Mr. Kelly has covered that in the last semester, and I'm sure you've all been through Acts chapter 8. But simply giving the highlights, Simon was baptized by Philip the deacon, yet within his heart he was not willing to lay aside the prestige and the influence that he had as a magician over the Samaritans and as the head of this Babylonian mystery religion. Obviously, there was not adequate counseling before this baptism, and that was perceived, of course, later on. Simon offered to purchase an apostleship and the power of transmitting the Holy Spirit, and this offer to purchase those positions and powers gave rise to the term simony, S-I-M-O-N-Y, as meaning the buying or selling of sacred things or ecclesiastical offices. We see in Acts 8 that Simon had been practicing magical arts in Samaria, and that the people had pronounced him to be the great power of God. You see that in verse 10. So he had made quite an impression. Now, Acts 2, of course, records the beginning of the true church on that first Pentecost, and then Acts 8 describes the origins of the false church. Now, what about Simon's activities after his rejection by Peter? As you're aware, he is not mentioned further in the Bible by name, after Acts 8. But the second century theologian Justin Martyr relates that Simon came to Rome later on. This was during the reign of the Roman Emperor Claudius. Claudius reigned from AD 41 to 54. Some of you may have seen the series on PBS, I, Claudius, familiar with something about his reign. Well, specifically, Simon Magus, came to Rome in the year AD 45. He would have been in his 40s at that time. And his goal, as it always was to gain a personal following for himself. And he was preaching his syncretistic religion, a combination of Babylonian and Persian and Oriental and other elements, Judaism, of course, and elements of Christianity, all into a system that he had devised, of course, with a Gnostic root. And he fascinated the people by his miracle working in Rome, as he had done in Samaria. There's an account that later on, during the reign of Nero, that Nero witnessed Simon Magus make a stone statue break into laughter. She, as you can imagine, impressed Nero no end. And also on one occasion made a statue of a brass snake come alive and, you know, wiggle around on the floor. So those sorts of demonic tricks impressed the people. And Simon came to be considered a god and was honored with a statue in Rome on an island in the Tiber River. And the inscription on this statue, according to, let's see, I think this is Justin Martyr, I think, mentions this. The inscription in Latin was Simoni Deo Sancto, which means to Simon the Holy God. To Simon the Holy God. So he was the Simon who was in Rome, not Simon Peter. I think you all know that. Catholic theology declares that the Apostle Peter was the first bishop of Rome, and that this present pope, John Paul II, is the 264th successor to Simon Peter as the bishop of Rome. But, as you probably have covered in other classes, Peter the Apostle was never in Rome until just before his death in the year AD 68, when he was crucified during the persecution of the Christians by Nero. The Apostle Paul, as we know, was the chief apostle to the Gentiles, including the Gentile Romans, not Simon Peter. The gospel of the circumcision was committed to Peter, as we read in Galatians 2:7. So Simon Magus was the Simon who had come to Rome, not Simon Peter. Yet historically, we know that the name Peter has been intimately associated with the area in Rome that is today known as Vatican City. We have, of course, St. Peter's Square and St. Peter's Basilica and so on. So why, if Simon Magus was the Simon who went to Rome, why do we have the name of Peter, Simon Peter, all over the place in Vatican City? Well, just a brief historical note here in that regard. And we see Satan's hand very clearly in this. The chief pagan gods in early civilizations were generally known by the name of Peter. For example, the chief Roman god was Jupiter, J-U-Peter. Jupiter. He was the chief Roman god. It was the Roman way of saying Zeus Peter. Jupiter. And also the priests of these early heathen gods were also referred to as Peters. And there are many different ways that you see this name spelled. Peter, of course, is one way. Then you have also Pator, P-A-T-O-R, P-E-T-O-R, P-A-T-R-E, and so on. to give you a whole list of variant spellings, but the priests were called Peters. This word meant interpreter. They were the interpreters of the heathen mysteries. And the original Peter, the original interpreter of the mysteries, of course, was Nimrod. There's a great deal we could go into in this regard, but time is fleeting. I'll just also mention that the sacred stone pillars in these religions, the idols, were also referred to as Peters or Petras, P-E-T-R-A-S. These stone pillars or idols that were worshipped as a part of these early religions. They were phallic symbols. And later, this word Petra or Petra, which originally referred to these stone idols, came to mean any large rock or stone. Hence the city of Petra. Of course, I won't go into the issue of there in Matthew 16:18, but there again the word Petra is used referring to a large massive rock, and of course that rock was Christ. The Petros, the stone, was the surname or the descriptive title that Jesus gave to Simon the Apostle. But the Petra, the large massive rock, of course, was Christ. But again, this traces back etymologically to these stone pillars or idols. In any case, we see that the name Peter, or various variants of the name, figured very highly in every phase of pagan worship. The gods were named Peters, the priests, the idols, and so on. And I should also mention that later this term Peter, or Pator, also took on a secular meaning. It came to generally mean father or parent. And this is probably because that in many of these ancient religions, the father was the chief priest of the family. In any case, you see here something of the evolution of words, and that's a study in itself. So Simon Peter, of course, was the apostle, but Simon Magus was also referred to as Simon Peter because he was the Peter, the interpreter, the priest of the pagan mystery religion. And hence, the name Simon Peter, referring to Simon Magus, is found today in the Vatican City very prominently. So Simon Magus was Simon Peter, Simon the chief god, or Simon the interpreter of the mysteries. Now, in Rome with him was his consort Helen. Helen, she was a, or had been, a public prostitute or a temple prostitute in the city of Tyre, according to Justin Martyr. And she, at that time, attached herself to Simon. And thinking about it, you know, what better type of person is there that could maybe teach and, you know, seduce the people away from the truth than someone who had been a temple prostitute? In any case, Helen had been overawed by Simon's demon powers and was persuaded to follow him. And we have speculated that this Helen, the consort of Simon Magus, was very possibly the woman of Samaria that Jesus had met in John 4, back in December of AD 28, when Jesus came to a city of Samaria, where Jacob's well was located, and this woman came to draw water. Remember, he said to her that you have had five husbands, and he whom you now have is not your husband, possibly referring to Simon Magus. In any case, Helen became very closely associated with Simon. Simon elevated her to the status of a goddess. And this is thought to possibly be the beginnings of Mary worship. He was the great god, as that statue in the Tiber River proclaimed. So he referred to her as the Queen of Heaven. And Simon and Helen were worshipped under the titles of Lord and Lady. Sometimes they were worshipped as incarnations of Zeus and Athena. Simon had images made of himself and of Helen. So here we see the old Babylonian idea of the male and female religious principles. Let me quote here from Justin Martyr. He says, in almost all the Samaritans and a few among other nations, including Romans, acknowledge and adore Simon as the first god. And one Helen, who went about with him at that time, who before had her stand in a brothel, they say was the first thought that was brought into being by Simon. So in other words, Simon claimed to have created Helen, his female companion, just by the process of thought, brought her into being. And there were all sorts of ideas about her previous existences. She claimed to have been the Egyptian goddess Isis, and so on. And even Helen of Troy. She claimed to be an incarnation of Helen of Troy. Let's skip ahead here. Well, quickly summarizing here. As the Christian churches began to grow in the West, and in fact began to grow rapidly, Simon saw the need to do something about this in order to gain these people for himself. So he seized on the name of Christ as a cloak for his own teachings. And again, these teachings were a mixture of Babylonian paganism, of Judaism, of Christianity, and Gnosticism, and so on. But with the label of Christianity, he appropriated a Christian vocabulary and other outward trappings in order to give a surface appearance of Christianity to his doctrines. He blended Christian and pagan philosophy. Again, this is syncretism. Justin Martyr mentions that, quote, all those who follow him are called Christians, unquote. So they were called Christians, but were not. So Simon, in other words, Christianized the religion of Nimrod and Balaam, and consequently has earned for himself the title of the father of heresy. Eusebius, the third one here on the board, says that Simon took the lead in all heresy. He was the chief heretic of that first century, the father of heresy. What were some of his teachings? Well, again, I've already mentioned that he had these dualistic beliefs. The Gnosticism was brought into Christianity by Simon Magus. I've already given you information about what those beliefs were. In addition, some of his teachings included that the Old Testament was done away. Irenaeus mentions that Simon rejected the Mosaic Law and, in fact, the entire Old Testament. Another teaching of Simon Magus was that with greater sin, there is greater grace. In other words, this, in essence, did away with the law. The idea was, well, let's let grace abound, so let's sin more. The greater we sin, the more grace bestowed on us, and that's a good thing, isn't it? To get all this grace. So let's let grace abound by letting sin abound. And that, again, does away with the law, in essence. There's a term for that, for doing away with the law. That is antinomianism. A-N-T-I-N-O-M-I-A-N-I-S-M. Antinomianism. Remember that Peter there in Acts 8 told Simon Magus that he perceived that he was in the gall of bitterness and in the bond of iniquity. And iniquity is lawlessness. Antinomianism. Simon honored the number 8. And if you ever find yourself in the Catholic Church, notice how often the number 8 appears. You know, the baptismal fonts, for example, are 8-sided. They're octagons, and so on. You just see how often 8 is employed in architecture. Also, the 8th day of the week is the first day of the week, and it's the one that Simon honored. Eusebius also mentions that Simon was involved in introducing pictures and statues into professing Christian worship. He talks about his followers falling down before pictures and statues and venturing to offer them worship by incense and sacrifices and libations and so on. What does that sound like? Also, sexual promiscuity was a large part of the practice of his religion. Eusebius says that his followers were involved in base and obscene practices, and every vile corruption that could either be done or devised, unquote. That's from Eusebius. So this was a sensual religion. He also introduced the idea that the priests himself and those under him were intermediaries between God and man, and could grant absolution. In Acts 8, verse 24, remember he said to Simon Peter, "Pray to the Lord for me." So he already had that idea that someone can pray to God for you and convince God to forgive you and that sort of thing. So these are some of the teachings of Simon Magus. And I've already mentioned that Paul was very active, as were some of the other apostles, in countering the work of Simon Magus and warning of this mystery of iniquity and so on, this mystery religion. Simon died probably around the year AD 68 in Rome. There are two accounts of how he died. One said that he tried to prove that he was a god by attempting to fly. According to this account, the Apostle Peter, who was indeed in Rome at that time, the Apostle Peter and Simon Magus were together before Nero, and Simon Magus was going to show Nero his superiority over the Apostle Peter by actually demonstrating the ability to fly, this occult ability, and jumped off a tower and fell to his death. Justin Martyr that this quote came from. It says that because of the Apostle Peter's prayers, the demon who bore Simon Magus was compelled to let him go. He fell to his death. And of course, levitation is a common power exhibited by magicians. And it's very possible that he had been able to do that, but not on this occasion. The other account is that he tried to prove he was a god by having himself buried alive and claiming that he would rise from the dead in 3 days. But he did not rise. A false messiah. In any case, Eusebius says that Simon Magus was succeeded by a disciple of his named Menander, M-E-N-A-N-D-E-R. Another Samaritan magician, Eusebius says he, quote, exhibited himself in his conduct an instrument of diabolical wickedness not inferior to Simon. So he had his successor. Okay, I had a bit of information here regarding the subsequent fate of Gnosticism, but I think I've said enough. Let's see. Well, in essence, his followers eventually came to divorce themselves from the name of Simon, but still retained his heresies. And even in Eusebius's day, there were many, according to Eusebius himself, who were still in the church and espousing the doctrines of Simon. Justin said that in his day many were still misled by Simon and by Gnosticism and were misleading others, and eventually these individuals became the chief element in the church, and those who held to true doctrine were forced out. But I won't give you all those details now. You've gotten the general picture. So if there are any questions, I'll answer them privately up front here afterwards. Thank you for your attention.